Blog Talk Radio.
On the way back. Good morning, and welcome to another version of Masonic Home Companion. It's great to have you here. This is the 363rd day of the year, the 28th of December, 2012. We have some philosophy to go over, some things Masonic from Manly P. Hall, and some events that will keep us, I'm sure, entertained and enthralled. The Samuel Johnson, Dr. Johnson, from the 18th century author and critic and lexicographer, said, "Adversity is the state in which man most easily becomes acquainted with himself." Who knew? Who knew? Being especially free of admirers, then, it's when he begins to understand his own thinking. He's an interesting observer of behavior and notions. A man is very apt to complain of the ingratitude of those who have risen far above him. It's interesting what people refer to as ambition. If you're with a group of people who are so-called ambitious, and everybody's acting the same, and there doesn't seem to be any ambition. If you're with people that are frightened about stepping out of the mold, coloring outside the lines, thinking outside the box, whatever, then all things must be, all things alien to that must be ambition. But it has a negative valence, doesn't it? We have a hard time embracing the idea that all things that are innovative are good. We want to personalize it and then compete against it. And such is our nature. I think I hope you're sitting back ready to join me with a cup of your favorite today in your comfortable chair. I hope it's comfortable wherever you are, or you're sitting in a comfortable seat, hands in the 10 and 2 position. Four-way flashers going because you're a Mason. Fedora firmly in place, driving 10 kilometers under the speed limit just to make your mark in the world. Not since we are the scourge of young drivers everywhere. Don't follow an old guy with a hat, eh? I know I said the same thing when I was of that age. Of course, I'm usually not inclined to think that we take a second seat to anybody. This is a rare and a special day in history for a lot of reasons. You know that Louis Armstrong did 78 takes on the tune that plays us in. So he did it on this day, the West End Blues, and it was not to be. First of its kind, one of a kind. Fascinating. This is the time of year when we start to draw a line and look at how our year has compared with past years. We get the chance to do that, especially if we get a little bit older, don't we? William Blake said, "A man who never alters his opinion, is like standing water, and breeds reptiles of the mind." Altering our opinion is what allows us to change and what allows us to progress. Otherwise, we're just doing the same thing we've always done and convincing ourselves we're doing it right. If you hear me sounding that way, please just give me a swift nod. It's easily done, hey? Doing the things we do now and doing them better, cheaper, and faster will take us so far, but it will not take us far enough. So said Peter. Martin Luther King said, "Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice. Justice at its best is love, correcting everything that stands against love." Enough to make you think. Jonathan Swift claimed every man desires to live long enough, but no man would be old. Swift lived between 1667 and he passed away in 1745. He was an Irish writer and satirist. Gives us a moment to pause. I've been reading through Dr. Joy Porter's a really interesting book, Native American Freemasonry, and trying to understand more about her before she gives us the Sankey lecture and on the 23rd of March coming up at Brock University. This is a very interesting read. It's the subtext on it is Native American Freemasonry, Associationalism and Performance in America. And she makes a very strong arguments why those two elements are important. Now, Dr. Porter is an associate dean and senior lecturer at Swansea University in Wales, and she's the co-author of Competing Voices from Native America, Fighting Words, and the co-author of the Cambridge Companion to Native American Literature. Her work began to, it really does challenge. I think there's no question about it. She talks about how television has been, she quotes, "It's a death blow to fraternalism." And then she goes on to make, this is not a frivolous mind at all, she goes on to make a very strong and credible argument. But what stopped me and gave me more room for pause was, my thinking started to go a bit sideways as I was reading her material, and I began to wonder about our survival as an order. Not the overall concept, but how the question came to mind, and I'll put it to you. We live in changing times and always have. Is the function of Freemasonry in man's life the same today as it was 150 years ago? Now, you could say, well, it's really hard for anybody to determine unless it was, you know, somebody that truly had lived that period and this period. But I'm not so much thinking about answering it subjectively. Every one of us would have his or her own opinion on that. But are there some objective facts that we can work with here that tell us? Compare. Well, I would think that, you know, the idea of exclusivity was part of Freemasonry, the initiatory process. There is an element of exclusivity. This notion of common man, it's open and available to common man, really doesn't, you know, it seems to be invalidated by the idea of this humble notion of good men. Not every man, it's good men. And the idea of self-improvement and the higher order of improvement, which is taught to us through philosophies and histories, I could be persuaded that that function has been replaced. Freemasonry requires work. It requires study, and that's part of the expectation. Not that everybody picks that up. Not that everybody is seeking that. But as Porter indicates, back in the 20s and 30s, those functions were met by other organizations that focused purely on socialization and enjoyment and having fun without the heavy lifting of philosophy or ritual or degree work or exclusivity, but just that pure joy. And those groups grew considerably in the 20s and 30s, in North America particularly. Now, I'm thinking in my mind that there is a difference in the way that Freemasonry has developed in North America compared to Britain, as there is with any culture, because of the history leading up to those events. That's why we can't just impose a way of politics and a way of life on another culture, because their history is unique to that group of people. Whether we feel we have the moral high ground or not, which we seem to have in North America many times, only to discover that hasn't been the case. What concerns me is, you know, once upon a time, once in our history, we were part and parcel of the estates that were infallible. The rule of the monarch was infallible, and at certain points, assumed a state of divinity. Read about the Sun King in France to find out what happened, what kind of degradation occurred in the human condition when authority was unchecked. Today we have more reason, more fact, that gives us pause to question so-called authority, and yet clearly an understanding that some form of authority is necessary to order, to avoid chaos. People in very key positions that have proven themselves time and time again infallible, or fallible. And so it's not that we're naive or mistrustful, but it's that we notice things. The erosion in confidence has occurred, I would put it to you, not because of a secularism, But in spite of a secularism, there has been so many times when we are problems and complications are brought to our attention that we don't want to see, where there has been corruption, corruption of the human mind, corruption of the spirit, corruption of the use and of rank and authority, which is why we find that any authority becomes overbearing over the course of time unless it is held to tight accountability. So in the future, I can only speculate, or it wouldn't be too much of a guess, that we're going to see an increased accountability of the positions of, and the authorities that we know today. But times have changed. We don't perhaps have the innocence that we did back decades or a century ago or a couple of centuries ago in regards to the systems, the estates. The estates have changed. They now seem, we can trivialize them. But and how do we thread our way as a large fraternal order through these changing times? When the reference points seem to be changing, not because we want them, but because they are. And do we, so the challenge I began to wonder about, little Java, thank you, was whether we have to, try to substantiate something that has already passed. You know, are we going to look like, we're going to be a bit foolish sounding, trying to support an idea that has been hollowed out. You know, I don't think we were ever designed to do that. We were designed to be fact-based, to be relying on science and observation and understand the arts, understand philosophy. Not to look at things that were hollow and to carry them with us as if they were the treasures of and defining characteristics of our order. That I think would just not wash. So my question isn't whether we do or not, but how do we do it? I'm strongly convinced that our understanding our history is essential. We are, after all, when the world looks at and makes up that great list of where everything fits, you and I and the things Freemasonic, are historical. And that, I think, gives us a bit difficult to deal with. Maybe that's why it was one of the reasons why we became such a threat to a fascist movement in the Second World War. We were persecuted along with other peoples. We were mocked because we had perhaps the most obvious of all, that sense of permanence, because of the fact that we are of history. Life, as you say, goes on, and so do we. Has the function of Freemasonry in a man's life changed? And we could think of many different ways where yes, it probably has, and it's not competing. I don't like the idea that we have to compete with television or we compete, but people go out of their way to tackle something that is more challenging, even though it's in their best interest? Well, the inclination in what we teach our children is to move away from those things. And not on an individual basis, but collectively we do. Come on. We've all heard people talk about trying to remove memory work from the craft, and yet, there's some very clear philosophical reasons why that's important. any of the people who have studied the Kabbal would understand that readily, of course. Even a superficial reading, that's a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it? Would give an indication of the importance. In part, it's because of this striving for perfection. And memory work was an element of that. Now, that maybe the more we know, the more we can realize the value of the things that are important to us. Maybe what I'm living through right now is a very innocent period. I don't realize the importance of geometry. I do in passing. But maybe if I study that more, that particular aspect of the order, relevance of mathematics will become clearer to me. The understanding of why Euclid and Pythagoras are embedded in our ritual and our work would be not lost to me. I can tell you, I don't think it that they are. It's we live through interesting times. So if we sit back and catch our breath today, and I hope you will. I hope you'll enjoy it. We're an order of a couple of million scattered around the world, and we come from various cultures. We are attempting to speak common language, but you know it's easy for us to, like any groups, to convince ourselves that what we're doing is right. I think it behooves us to look at look at ourselves objectively. Are we achieving the goals? Are we as multicultural and encompassing and inclusive as we claim? Well, there's always work to be done before we start to, I think, base a discussion on criticism. I don't think that's very prudent. I think we need to come to sort of a common understanding that there's certain evidences that are acceptable. Like we could do more in a lot of areas. We could say that about a lot of things. A lot of people could say that. Not to hide or shirk our responsibility, but I think it's a fact of life that. Our economics is changing the way that we live. Expectations in education are contributing to that. People want opportunity, and we hope our children will have opportunity. So we're striving to give them the best education that we can. With education, just like you and I, the more we're educated, the more our Masonic literacy improves, the greater the change in our expectations, the change in our expectations of ourselves, of the Masonic governance, and the goals of Freemasonry. So, is it fair to say that we've had some remarkable discoveries? And I think the first area would be probably in the area of, it's mankind. It is astronomy, and then, exploring the universe, and then biology, exploring the world around us, chemistry, exploring looking at the world under a microscope, and then earth science, trying to figure out what's under our feet, evolution, exploring the past, genetics, trying to figure out what makes me, or you, medicine and health. And then we try to explore how stuff works, physics. We figured out that the planets move about 2000 BC to 500 BC. 1,000 years of observations reveal that there are stars that move in the sky and follow patterns, showing that the Earth is part of a solar system of planets separate from the fixed stars. People like you and I, paying attention, watching these spots of light in the night sky,
we didn't have to compete with electric lights, you know, that, what do they call it, light pollution now. 1543, Nicholas Copernicus took one for the team and said that the earth moves. That was in 1543. And he placed the sun, not the earth, at the center of the solar system. Boy, we were collectively unhappy with Nick. And we censored him pretty heavily. Is it true? Yeah. Turns out everything you said, it wasn't, there were others that said it, but you know, we have to find paint a target on somebody. So, and then Johannes Kepler discovered or devised the mathematical laws that successfully and accurately predict the motions of the planets. He did that a little later than Copernicus. Kepler was working in 1605 to 1609, short little window. And about that same time, 1609 to 1612, Galileo discovered that Jupiter has moons, much like the Earth, and proving that Copernicus, not Ptolemy, is right. Of course, you know Ptolemy, who said that everything revolves around the Earth. Copernicus believes that Earth is not unique, but instead resembles other planets. Now, it's 1705. This is getting remarkably interesting for Masonic purposes, of course. Halley's Comet. Edmund Halley proved that the comets orbit the sun like the planets and successfully predicted the return of Halley's Comet. He determined that the comets were seen in 1531 and 1607, and they were the same object following a 76-year orbit. So Halley's prediction was proven in 1758 when the comet came back. Unfortunately, Halley had died in 1742. So he knew the math. In 1780 to 1834, the telescope maker William Herschel and his sister Caroline mapped the entire sky and proved that our solar system resides in a gigantic disk of stars that bulges in the center. They called it the Milky Way. Herschel's technique involved taking a sample count of stars in the field of view of his telescope. His final count shows more than 90,000 stars in 2,400 sample areas. Later studies confirm that our galaxy is disc-shaped, but find that the sun is not near the center and that the system is considerably larger than Herschel's estimation. Not so very long ago, huh? 1915 to 1919, the period where my grandfather would be born in, Albert Einstein unveiled his theory of general relativity, in which he proposed that mass warps both time and space. Therefore, large masses can bend light. This theory was proven in 1919 by astronomers using a solar eclipse as a test. You particle physicists and string theorists go wild on that. Right. It's hard to dismiss them. Oh, I should add here something about the Higgs boson here. And then in 1924, Edwin Hubble determined that the distance to many nearby galaxies was getting even further away from us, the faster they are flying away from us. They're flying faster. His calculations proved that the universe is expanding. And then in 1932, man, it's not that long ago, the center of the Milky Way emits radio waves. This is Carl Jansky, invented radio astronomy and discovered a strange radio-emitting object in the center of the Milky Way. He was doing experiments on radio wavelength interference for his employer, Bell Telephone Labs, when he detected three groups of static: local thunderstorms, distant thunderstorms, and a steady hiss-type static. He determined that the static was coming from an unknown source. Cosmic microwave background radiation, 1964. Cadillacs were huge. Pontiacs were bigger. Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson discovered cosmic microwave background radiation. Gamma ray bursts, the sci-fi Wunderkinder, 1969 to 1997. The two-decade-long mystery of gamma ray bursts is solved by a host of sophisticated ground-based and orbiting telescopes. Planets around other stars. Astronomers found that in 1995 to 2004, found a host of extrasolar planets as a result of improved telescope technology. The universe is accelerating, 1998 to 2000. Unexpectedly, astronomers find that instead of slowing down due to the pull of gravity, the expansion of the universe at great distances is accelerating. If these observations are correct and the trend continues, it will result in the inability to see other galaxies. A new theory of the end of the universe based on this finding has been called the Big Rip. So, something to, it's not all that we are, and all that we do, but it's a part of it. And we can celebrate that, I think, and probably should. Now, let's leave science for a little, just for a minute, and tuck in, we can come back to that, of course, and tuck into a bit of Manly P. Hall. I hope all of you are getting ready for the return of the new year celebration. We're coming up to 2013. It seems like only yesterday that it was 1913, and people in 1913 were dealing with economic challenges. Necessary. Well, there was conflict in the Balkans, wasn't there? I don't think anybody was able to predict what was going to happen a few short years from then. I hope in the meantime it teaches us to live well and live for the moment and do what we can to make life more enjoyable. And no matter how big or how small, you and I can be the grown-up Boy Scouts, I guess. And we can commit random acts of kindness to people that we don't know for no other reason than it makes the world a better place. Let's see what Manly Hall might say, if you don't mind. We're going to talk a little bit about Manly again. Here he is giving us information about the entered apprentice. And he says there are three grand steps in the unfoldment of the human soul before it completes the dwelling place of the spirit. These have been called respectively youth, manhood, and old age, or, as the Mason would say, the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, and the master builder. So you can see that Manly P. Hall is taking a particular context and discussing it with us. All life passes through these three grand stages of human consciousness. So he's not talking about the corporal experience, you know, aging our bodies. He's talking about consciousness. They can be listed as the man on the outside looking in, the man going in, and the man inside. The path of human life is governed, as all things are, by the laws of analogy. And as at birth we start our pilgrimage through youth and manhood and old age, so the spiritual consciousness of man in his cosmic path of unfoldment passes from unconscious to perfect consciousness in the grand lodge of the universe. Before the initiation of the entered apprentice degree can be properly understood and appreciated, certain requirements must be considered, not merely those of the physical world, but those of the spiritual world. The Mason must realize that his true initiation is a spiritual and not a physical ritual, and that his initiation into the living temple of the spiritual hierarchy regulating Freemasonry may not occur until years after he has taken the physical degree, or spiritually he may be a Grand Master before he comes into the world. This is the fellow working with the idea that the temple is of the mind. the one that we're trying to construct, the one that was broken down and rebuilt, is in their mind. There are probably few instances in the history of Freemasonry where the spiritual ordination of the aspiring seeker took place at the same time as the physical initiation, because the true initiation depends upon the cultivation of certain soul qualities. An individual and personal matter which is left entirely to the volition of the mystic Mason, and which he must carry out in silence and alone. The court of the tabernacle of the ancient Jews was divided into three parts: the outer court, the holy place, and the most holy of holies. These three divisions represent the three grand divisions of human consciousness. The degree of entered apprentice is acquired when the student signifies his intention to take the rough ashlar, which he cuts from the quarry and prepares for the truing of the fellow craft. In other words, the first degree is really one of preparation. It is a material step dealing with material things, for all spiritual life must be raised upon a material foundation. 7 is the number of the entered apprentices, as it relates to the 7 liberal arts and sciences. And these are the powers with which the entered apprentice must labor before he is worthy to go outward into the more elevated and advanced degrees. There are much mistaken who believe that they can reach the spiritual planes of nature without first passing through and molding matter into the expression of spiritual power. For the first stage in the growth of a Master Mason is mastery of the concrete conditions of life and the developments of sense centers, which will later become channels for the expression of spiritual truths. All growth is a gradual procedure carried on in an orderly, masterly way, as exemplified by the opening and closing of a lodge. The universe is divided into planes, and these planes are divided from each other by the rates of vibration which pass through them. As the spiritual consciousness progresses through the chain, the lower loose connection with it, when it has raised itself above their level, until finally only the grandmasters are capable of remaining in session, and unknown even to the Master Mason, it finally passes back again to the spiritual hierarchy from which it came. So here Hall is teaching us that if you don't pick up on it, as the spiritual consciousness progresses through this chain, the lower lose connection with it. If you have a lower spiritual consciousness, you lose connection with the process. And until the higher, and as he says, he refers to things metaphorically, of course. The grandmasters are those who are able to recognize and sustain those connections with consciousness, growing consciousness. Action is the keynote of the entered apprentice lodge. All growth is the result of exercise and the intensifying of vibratory rates. It is through exercise that the muscles of the human body are strengthened. It is through the 7 liberal arts and sciences that the human mind receives certain impulses which in turn stimulate internal centers of consciousness. These centers of consciousness, through still greater development, will later give fuller expression to those inner powers. But the entered apprentice has for his first duty the awakening of these powers. And like the youth of whom he is a symbol, his ideals and labors must be closely tied to concrete things. For him, both points of the compass are under the square. For him, the reasons which manifest through the heart and mind, the two polarities of expression, are darkened and concealed beneath the square which measures the block of bodies. He knows not the reason why. His work is to follow the directions of those whose knowledge is greater than his own. But as the result of the application of energies through action and reaction, he slowly builds and evolves the powers of discrimination and the strength of character which mark the fellowcraft degree. It is obvious that the rough ashlar symbolizes the body. It also represents cosmic root substance, which is taken out of the quarry of the universe by the first expression of intelligence, and molded by them into ever finer and more perfect lines until finally it becomes the perfect stone for the builder's temple. So here we have an interesting analogy. We'll come back to this in future shows. But here we have an interesting analogy, which rides on the idea of growing consciousness and an ultimate outcome of to remind us that this is a progressive, that growing consciousness is just that, it's progressive, that there is a goal, a purpose, or a meaning. If anything, Freemasonry strives to understand. I would suggest to you that there's very little that we do as Freemasons that doesn't contain significant elements of information that allow us to retrieve meaning. The meaning of life. It gets very hard to sit down in a busy or crowded room with people moving in all different kinds of orbits around us and contemplate the things that are important. I think a lot of people may even feel that it would be easier if somebody could come along and just tell us what's important, and I'll believe you. That's feasible, being able to accept the ideas of another person. I think it keeps us operating as children. And we remain in that state until we begin to say and do things and become because of our own volition. The maturity of the man, the growing consciousness. And that seems to come when we have, a greater respect for the fact that we have opinions, but there are so many things that you and I are unaware that to walk around claiming that we have a command of all that doesn't agree with us is truly naive. Remember, we live in a world where people still believe that exercising an authority is earning respect. Never, ever. Respect is what is earned. It's not commanded. We can coerce. We can create fear. We can intimidate. We can overwhelm. We can overpower. But you can even get people to claim that it's all called respect, but it isn't. Respect is earned, but a Freemason would know that leadership is an act of humility, an act of recognizing the importance of all the people in the organization, no matter their rank. Today we may walk through the flowery paths of, and you know the rest of that. Tomorrow, our circumstance change. And when things change, the way we look at it, sometimes we find who our true friends are. People that walk away from us because our circumstance changed. Well, and sometimes that's disappointing. Whether it comes over a change in people's lives or a change in health. We call these things, these changes, reducing discrimination. But sometimes, you know, it's a little deeper, more complicated question than that. We want to do the right thing, the ethical thing, but we don't necessarily always know what that is. It's not always easy. It doesn't always pop out. Carving out the world in black and white, right and wrong. Oh, man, where do we start with that one? We do the best we can. We need information and dialogue. I hope that Masons would embrace the idea of the continued discussion. All of the complications and challenges, barriers, or if you're of the kind that calls things problems, all of that begin to break down when we keep talking about them. But we don't do it to hector the order. We see a few fellows that go overboard and seem to realize that as an individual, they can challenge the authority of a very large operation. They've lost, in my mind, they've lost perspective to be bellyaching or complaining in a room of 1,000 people ties up, you know, the attention and time of 1,000 people. So if I do that, or anybody does that, I would expect that what they have to say should be reasonably important and not just driven by their own ego. Yeah, yeah, we were all on our mother's lap once upon a time being told we were brilliant and we could do anything if we tried. Reason and maturity teach us that that people's abilities vary, and that everything has a functional, every work, a bit of work has a functional role that contributes to the world that we live in, to our culture. But keeping the discussion of our problems alive is essential. It needs to be done in a thoughtful and reasonable way. If we're talking about initiating discussion about complications, one of the finest ways to resolve complications is to learn and realize that the most effective, powerful tool in communication is the ability to listen. To offer a person who is not used to it an opportunity to be understood. Now, when you were given your first two-wheeler, did you know how to ride it? Yeah, maybe you were the savant that figured it out, but you know what I mean. You had to practice a little bit, get that balance right, figure out, keep those pedals moving, and then you could do it with no hands. The same thing when a person is receiving undivided attention. It's an unsettling experience in a world that can often leave us feeling that we're ignored. So the first time you give a person your undivided attention, it's naive to think that they're going to necessarily recognize it and be practiced enough to know how what it means and what it is communicating. So if you only do it once and then walk away feeling disappointed because the person, quote, didn't get it, well, that's you. It's got nothing to do with the process. It's when people can walk away from you 10 times 10 and realize that you have an ability to listen, that perhaps they'll become self-conscious and realize, whoa, this is a person that is beginning to understand me. You know, you do that, then you begin to see the true nature of people, the difference between the way they are and the way they think they are. the silence, being able to listen is a very, very, very powerful gesture. But it is unsettling. So, you know, we need to move forward with this, with our discussions, and allow people or acknowledge that people will, if they have that kind of influence over us by the fact that we're listening to them, that they're likely going to mess up anywhere where people are have power that they've never had before. No matter how slight, they have to learn how to define it. And we do that as people by understating and overstating. We mess up. And then we learn from messing up. And then we progress. And sometimes we mess up over and over and over and over again. History is full of examples. So you and I, as scientists of the consciousness of people, as students of careful observation, we can even observe people observing people. You know, we need then to equip ourselves with tolerance. That it's not that we've done something wrong or that the exercise has been unproductive. This is a sorting. Some people may never, never understand. Others will pick up on it. So are you expecting a pearl in every oyster that you open? Ha ha. Well, brother, it takes a bit more work than that, doesn't it? If you've ever been on oyster beds, oysters taste delicious, but not everyone contains a pearl. Not every pearl is perfect. Maybe you and I can wish for that. We can get out our magic wand and make it happen, but not likely, eh? Not likely. We're going to be able to bring out the solutions to complications by discussion, thoughtful, always thoughtful discussion, temperate, not rash, with enough candor to carry the moment, but not too much candor that allows us to be insolent and ill-mannered. So this is how we tend to become the mason that we are. When you become the mason, the thinking changes. The thinking changes greatly. Let's say we look a little bit at what's going on in history around this period of time. 1610, Henry Hudson saw Hudson's Bay. I hope you're wearing your long underwear. And then, our friend Galileo was questioned by the Inquisition in 1615. What are you up to saying these things, you heretic? They censored him quite well for that. Maybe you and I can earn the same distinction of being questioned and censored and being found later right. I hope he lived well in his heart, knowing that he was speaking truth. In 1632, the philosopher John Locke was born. And, one of the most remarkable painters of the Dutch period, Jan Vermeer, was born in 1632. Fascinating, fascinating work. 1636, Harvard was founded in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we saw Louis XIII died in 1643. Louis XIV assumed the throne. Bit of a whack job, I thought, but who am I to say? He felt he was sun god, wasn't he? 1642, Isaac Newton was born. And it was the same year Galileo died. Man. 1653, the Taj Mahal was completed. That was the same year Oliver Cromwell, I remember the English Civil War, took the title of Lord Protector. 1653. The English Parliament dissolved in 1655 by Cromwell. He liked the idea, but he found it was too much work as democracy. 1658, Ollie died too. And 1666 was the year that Isaac Newton so-called discovered gravitation. Say he observed, but it was the same year that London burned for 5 days. Great fire. And it was just shortly after that, 1669, that Rembrandt died. And then in 1675, Jan Vermeer died. Unbelievable. Then we had 1685, Johann Sebastian Bach was born. Handel was born. And Louis the 14th, in true despotic monarchist style, revoked the Edict of Nantes and began persecutions of the Huguenots. Those poor Protestants. Let's get rid of them. And of course, that's where we had De Solier coming to Britain as a small boy, or his family did. James II fled from England in 1688, just shortly after that. And then in 1694, the Bank of England was formed. Ooh-wee, hold me down. That's a lot of interesting trivia for you to hear. Just remember this day in history was when Louis Armstrong recorded 78 versions of that of our introductory song, the West End Blues. I don't know why he'd do that, but hey, I always liked the tune. Now we were going to get into a little bit more about Manly Hall, but before I do that, I'd like you to check out a tune here and see what you think. This is a canon by Bach. Thank you. little bit of Bach in the morning. I'm going to talk a bit. I promised to bring the idea of music into the program, just to underline the idea that in our past, music seemed to have a more central place in our lodges. I'd like to think that we have figured out that we don't necessarily have to be concert pianists or have an organist in our lodge. There's one very unique lodge in Ontario that has has an organist, but the person is responsible for handling musical passages for the lodge meeting. And with each one, explains a bit of history and put together a program that captures the spirit and moment of the lodge meeting. And I think it's spellbinding. It's something that I would only hope that I know not everybody would necessarily find that style of music, different styles of music, that his particular style of music captivating, but it's the idea that this is what he's trying to achieve. And then if we suspend our need for control for a second, we can really get into what the person is attempting to do. And I it's not to say all the music is very staid, in classical form, but it's music with a message, music that speaks to us. So today I want to just introduce another composer. We'll go through the classical composers, and then we'll get into some contemporary artists later on in the program as we go along. Today I want to talk about Frédéric François Chopin. This is a fellow that we may know as a composer and virtuoso pianist. He was born, we think, either March 1st or 22nd of February, 1810. And he died on the 17th of October, 1849. Widely considered one of the greatest romantic composers. And he was born in a village in the Duchy of Warsaw. And he, even at an early age, people recognized his talent. And he grew up in Warsaw and completed his education there. And he composed many of his mature works there before leaving Poland in 1813. He was only 20 years old. And that was just before the November 1830 uprising. So following the Russian suppression of the uprising, he settled in Paris as part of Poland's great emigration. And during the remaining 19 years of his life, that's right, he died quite young, 39, he gave only 30 public performances, preferring the more intimate atmosphere of the salon. He supported himself by selling his compositions and teaching piano. After some romantic dalliances with Polish women, including an engagement that just did not work, he carried on a relationship with the French writer Amantine Dupin, also known as Georges Sand. For most of his life, Chopin suffered from poor health. He died at age 39. His works are primarily for solo piano, but he wrote two piano concertos and chamber pieces and some songs to Polish lyrics. His piano works are often technically demanding, with an emphasis on nuance and expressive depth. He invented the instrumental ballade and made major innovations in the production of music for piano. So there you have a bit about. I'll try and pull up some music here from Chopin so that you have a taste of it. The order has been growing remarkably this year. I think we've seen a significant bit of progress with the activities of our Grand Lodge. Things seem to be moving ahead. We We've seen, as Joy Porter reminded us, we've seen a decline in global membership since the 30s. And it seems that trajectory is continuing to this day. We are experiencing influences and forces that are really necessarily beyond our control, but it's quite important that we try to understand. And right now, I think we're in a period of trying to understand. So we're hearing some speculations about the reasons why. It's not necessarily a negative event. You and I might think, well, bigger is better. But, you know, what's more important, I think we have all agreed, is the quality of our work and our understanding. On an individual basis, I hope we will continue to expand our Masonic literacy, that we will begin to move from the speculative Freemason that we begin with to operative, where we put the ideas into action. That's considerably more important than just producing, all becoming degree mills. Porter also explained that, over the past decades, there have been, the nature of initiation has changed, and the experience in some ways has become passive. And it struck me that it was troubling for me to read this portion of her scholarly work, where she was talking about initiations of 1,000 men at a time. Well, the experience then, when she adds that the experience became passive, you know, we could be happy on one point that we have 1,000 more members. But on the other hand, we also have a responsibility for the experience to try and provide the emotional experience that we know is part of the initiation. The balancing act. If we knew then what we know now, we might have done things differently. We know that that we try to preserve a certain experience. Often, I think when we talk about our actions, you know, when we're criticized for, you know, B-grade actors doing the ritual, you know, people that aren't prepared, offering ritual that's so chopped up that it's hard to follow. You know, that's really not doing anybody a service. If our primary purpose is to educate, that's probably not the way we want to go about it. So we have to do better in that regard by thinking about the overall experience for the new fellow coming through the door, not our own. But that said, if our senior members have sat through 3,000 of this degree, I think your observation is going to be different than the first time or second time that you experienced it. I think those fellows are going to be wanting sharpness. They're going to be wanting enthusiasm, something that's thoughtful, that takes everything into account, takes the audience into account. The more mature the people doing the work, the more thoughtful the group is toward the audience. And so we don't see perhaps the idle chatter going on between two people while an audience sits there, you know, really having nothing vested in listening to the idle chatter. It's when things move along at a pace that takes into account first and foremost the audience. Often those little side bars can be done privately and should be, rather than then I think risk annoying our more senior members who have been there for a great long time, seen hundreds of these degrees, and are and should be considered part of the whole process. I think it's wrong-minded of anyone to take their needs for granted as well. And so I never understood that there was a hierarchy where we had one thing in our life being predominant and everything else being subordinate. I always, perhaps I'm wrong, but the geometry of Freemasonry taught me about balance. Can you balance off your responsibilities, including your responsibility as a Mason? It saddens me when I hear people just dismissing a commitment to the order because of other areas of their life. I know that they have not considered it and probably have been taught that life is a hierarchy. You know, some things come first, other things come second, other things come third. But as we go through life, it seems that we learn that we have, it's a little bit simplistic to think that everything's going to fall into line. We have to keep everything balanced. So we have responsibilities in a number of areas at the same time. And how do we do that without feeling that the compromise is wasteful? Of course, it's always easy to simplify it and say, this is my primary goal. Yeah, but the lessons of Freemasonry teach us otherwise, that we have a great many responsibilities. Those in front of us and those oblique. That there's, you know, maybe that's what is meant when we talk about the veils between different levels of reality. That we can, they seem almost transparent. That it's a matter of consciousness and awareness. One would hope that our Masonic order does express the ethical goals of Freemasonry. The ethics, I think, speak about understanding the deeper meaning, understanding a purpose. And I know that it's really tedious to do that all the time. Some of us come wanting an opportunity for serenity, for focus, for the seriousness of the degree to be prominent. Not that I don't like that many of us don't like a good laugh and a warm handshake. I think that's important. But there's also, you know, it's sort of like saying there's a time and a place for everything. I'd like to think that the time for a bit of reverence for what we express comes through. Because everybody in the room gets it. Everybody is realizing that, again, it's the balance point between the glad handing and the gravity of the situation. I wouldn't go to your wedding feeling that I should be weeping. But there's a seriousness where you don't want the distractions. You want to maintain the focus on the two people. There's a point in where we can be counterproductive in our efforts to bring our notion of what should be to a room. The more we understand about Freemasonry, then it's easier for us to synthesize our bring together the our notions with the master's notions with the experience we're trying to convey. KT asteroid theory of dinosaur extinction comes to mind. Big explosion, and boom, everything was gone. But now we find out that there's still little dinosaurs flying around, call them birds. 1980, Walter Alvarez found high levels of iridium and rock core samples around the world as evidence that an asteroid impact caused the extinction of dinosaurs. It this layer 65 million years ago lies between the rocks of the Cretaceous and Tertiary periods and coincides with the mass extinction of dinosaurs. Who knew? Charles Walcott exposed a motherlode of Cambrian fossils high in the Canadian Rocky Mountains in 1909 and providing a glimpse of what life was like on Earth more than 500 million years ago. His collection, more than 65,000 specimens, and he collected them and classified each and discovered that the fossils are ancestors of living animals. Thanks, Chuck. In 1858, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. Now, Chuck was an interesting guy. He came from a family of lawyers. And he could have had, he was offered. And I guess there was a bit of, you know, pushback when he said, I want to go and follow these things. I want to go and check this stuff out. And he had the training. He had the practice. Social position. It's like, hey, sonny boy, you know, get yourself a new suit and go into the family business. Then he had to follow his own inclination. Darwin had served as an unpaid naturalist on the HMS Beagle, which set out on a 5-year scientific expedition to the Pacific coast of South America in early 1832. The data he collected on the expedition, especially specimens from the Galapagos Islands, was the inspiration for his theories on evolution by the mechanisms of natural selection. His work has been at the center of controversy ever since it was published. Well, you know that he may not have been the original or only person to think of a theory, realize a theory of natural selection. Do a little bit of work or reading about the period, and you'll find that, you know, he is given, rightfully so, he's given credit. You know, you have to credit somebody. So, all right, we'll, Chuck, step up here. He wasn't the only one. It was like Tesla, Tesla's patents being stolen by, he couldn't afford to do things. And we have Edison coming along and grabbing things up. Oh, my goodness. You know, another, how dare me. But I think history shows us that some of these things weren't created by these people, that were credited with them. As time goes by, we learn more and we correct. Now, which is the revisionist of history? Revisionism is when we sort of take things out of history because it suits our purpose. There's a difference between that and correcting errors in what we know about history. You know, it's like anything. As our scholars are able to go through new discoveries, their analysis of material, new ways of testing and measuring things, is producing new information that's changing the way we think. Is it to say that the way we think we had thought was wrong? Well, wrong it doesn't really speak well to it. In a sense, yeah, but more strikingly, it was we were using information and coming up with concepts that explain the information that we had the best way we could at the time. So even scripture, you know, we're not so very long ago, the material that we're using was 1500 years old. Well, now we're getting into material that was written 500 and 300 years after the birth of, in the Protestant faith, after the birth of Christ. So are we thinking that this is going to change the volume as it's written? Already has. Are we going to continue to use worn out tools because that's the way we think that they should be? Well, we once thought that the Earth was the center of the universe, and good-minded men, ethical men, were adamant that that's the way it is. And anybody that challenged that idea was heretical. We found that that's wrong. We need to be able to use the new and assimilate those ideas. So the work for us is with young people, we can embrace their enthusiasm, but we need to be able to put them on a healthy path. So they're just not running, chasing their tails all over the place, you know, chasing up things that we have work to, that needs to be carried forward. And we need that youthful enthusiasm in order to help us achieve it, that youthful optimism, that can-do approach to the world. But we also need to have the ideas well thought out, and that takes time, and it takes scholarship. And it's more than opinion. It's opinion based on clear evidence, ethical reasoning. Right and wrong? Is it wrong that we're changing things? No, that's the way it's always been. Change has always been part of our daily lives, and particularly part of the expression of Freemasonry. I'll ask you, I'm going to meet with you again on New Year's Day, I hope. And I'll be asking you questions about how you think the order has continued and expanded in so many cultures for hundreds and hundreds of years. How? Has it been because everybody was like you and me? Lord help us if that was the case, if they were like me. I hope they were more like you. But I only get a small part of what's going on. I only understand a small part. Hundreds of years ago, people wouldn't have had access to the library that I have sitting here in my room at my fingertips with a couple of computer screens. The material that they were handed down, if you imagine hand to mouth to ear, you know, we would want people to be, I would hope, talk about what that means. You've just taught me something. You've just whispered something to me. You've told me something in private. Now tell me, give me your opinion about what it means. Now we use oxygen. We are in surgeries, we use oxygen. 1770s, Joseph Priestley discovered it. Before that, didn't have it. Or would we say, well, when Freemasonry began, 1717, there was no oxygen, therefore we should not use this. Come on. Absolutely absurd. Absolutely absurd. I don't like to, you know, personally, I don't like science that doesn't agree with my narrow-minded view of the world. Yes, I totally enjoy being made to look foolish, except I resent that most of all. I like to be well-prepared. The only way to be well-prepared, and I think what speaks ethically to Masons, is to be broad-minded, to be open-minded. If you catch yourself starting to make value judgments, ask yourself, what's wrong with the picture? We've got to go beyond individual experience. Otherwise, all that we will ever be is based on our own individual experience. That way, we never learn from the experience of another man. We come into the order blindfolded and ignorant. We come into life ignorant, blindfolded. Greatest threat to everything that we are, I would say, and suggest to you, is ignorance. Either people just don't care, or they don't know. You, even if you discover a meaning that speaks to you, the next task is, what do you do about it? It's not a simple matter of, nothing simple in life, I think. Thank goodness for the discoveries that you and I get to use to our benefit. Penicillin, Alexander Fleming, and then Howard Florey and Boris Chain isolated and purified penicillin in 1920s and 30s. And it came completely by accident when Fleming noticed that mold had killed a bacteria sample in a petri dish that is languishing under a pile in his lab's sink. He isolates the sample of the mold and identifies it as Penicillium notatum. With controlled experimentation, Florey and Chain later find the compound cures mice with bacterial infections. Did we use, in 1920, Frederick Banting, a Canadian, and his colleagues discovered the hormone insulin? every diabetic understands the importance. Every father of a diabetic child, every mother of a diabetic child. Louis Pasteur, do we pay attention? The 1800s, he discovered certain microbes are disease-causing agents, and for the, at the time, the origin of diseases such as cholera and anthrax and rabies was a mystery. He formulated a germ theory and postulated that these diseases and many others were caused by bacteria. I much prefer superstition, that the muses were out of balance, that the biles were, I had too much black bile, I needed a good bleeding, that I had not properly recognized and faithfully supported my my deity. Look, I hope you come back. I've got to, I'm wrapping up and doing some housekeeping here, cleaning up some articles that have been under the sink for a while. I want to speak with you about a bit of a change. We'll be adding more music in the future. In the meantime, you come back and see me, and I look forward to. And this is a tune that was written by a Mason. You take care of yourself and each other. May the great architect of the universe watch over you. Have fun.
Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle. That's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of
life. For life is quite absurd. Face the curtain with a bang. Forget about your seat. Give the audience a grin. Enjoy it. It's your last chance at the end.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit. You look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is.
Always look on the bright side of life.
And what are you going to lose? You know, you come from nothing, you're going back to nothing. Are you